Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. May it please the Court, Cheryl Gordon-McLeod on behalf of Tuit Nguyen, and I'm joined at counsel table by co-counsel Mr. Mestel. Your Honor, there was one piece of evidence in this case that was qualitatively different from the paper trail, from the medical probes, from the Davies claims that he was selling to Thu Nguyen rather than Tuit Nguyen, and it was the words of co-defendant Cess Merck saying that he was selling medical devices, illegally stolen medical devices, to Tuit Nguyen. My aim this morning is to focus on the Crawford problem posed by the admission of those statements and the Santos problem posed by the money laundering conviction.
Okay, am I correct that if there's a Crawford violation, then the convictions for possessing stolen property, for conspiring to possess it, and for money laundering all have to be reversed?
That's my understanding, that the conviction for
a violation that's not harmless.
I'm sorry?
If there's a violation that is not harmless error.
Correct. That my understanding is that they would all fall. The two conspiracy charges, the interstate transportation of stolen property charge, and the two introduction of misbranded medical.
But the Crawford issue would not vitiate, if it succeeds, would not vitiate the misbranding convictions. In other words,
I understand the question. I'm sorry.
She was also convicted of introducing devices into foreign commerce that were misbranded or into national commerce. In my understanding,
changing serial numbers.
Right. Well, my thought
was
that
the Crawford issue doesn't relate to that. So if it does, you better illuminate me.
Well, I apologize, but I'm going to be thinking about out loud on that one. The misbranding elements are that it was a device, that it was misbranded, intent to defraud or mislead.
It doesn't seem to have anything to do with whether it was stolen property. Why don't you think about it, and you can cover it in your rebuttal.
Thank you. I would add to that, though, that remember that we have the problem on the misbranding instructions in that they left out the element of materiality. The government agrees that materiality.
No, I understand that.
Okay.
That's another issue.
Okay. That is another issue.
I'm just trying to figure out how far we go with the appellant if we accept the Crawford violation.
I understand the distinction you're drawing between those convictions, and I don't have an answer for you at the moment about those. As to all the other convictions, though, Crawford barred the admission of non-testifying co-defendant Cess Merck's testimony because they were testimonial statements elicited during the course of a criminal investigation by a federal special agent, and they were admitted over defendants' repeated motions in limine that they be excluded.
Ms. McLeod, the standard of review here could be significant. So maybe you could review with us. My understanding is that the appellant objected to the hearsay statement, a motion in limine, and after oral argument, after the opening statement, and that the judge said she didn't have to further object, that it was preserved, but then did not object when the testimony came in.
That's correct, but I'd like to add to that that the initial motion in limine, which is in the ER, and I cited to page 199, which I believe was the hearsay objection, I should also have cited to ER 208, which is the page at which the actual confrontation clause objection appears, and that it's written in broad statements as an objection to the admission of this evidence. Now, it begins by saying we've been alerted by that the government may be seeking to introduce it. It doesn't say we've been alerted that CIS Merck may be seeking to introduce it. The reason, of course, is that Merck never alerted anybody, and the motion in limine is what people bring to the trial court based on what they know in advance of trial. But the relief requested was broad. The relief requested was exclusion of Merck's testimony implicating Tuit Nguyen. It didn't say excluded only if the government admits it. Thereafter, of course, there was the first trial in which Mr. Westinghouse gave the opening statement. That was on March 13th in court. Judge Lasnik said, I'm going to deny your motion to exclude those. I think there's a conspiracy here. I don't want anybody to cross the Bruton line, but I think there's a conspiracy here, so I'm going to deny Mr. Mestel your motion. Well, then there was an opening statement in which government counsel referred to Merck's statements, specifically pointing to Tuit Nguyen receiving probes in exchange for money. A week later, March 20th, we're back
so
at a...
What was Merck's counsel's strategy in doing that?
Well, it's a good question.
Not and, to blame her?
It's a good question, and I say that because it's one that couldn't have been predicted in advance of trial. Otherwise, we might all be blaming Mr. Mestel for not having raised it in his motion in limine. The best I can figure out is that he was trying to get his client across as an honest guy who came forward. But that's the best that I can do with it. To further answer your question, Judge Gould, defense counsel re-raised it immediately before the second trial and said, you know, an opening statement in the first trial, government counsel specifically used Merck's words introduced through Agent Borden to inculpate my client, Tuit Nguyen. This is a problem because Tuit Nguyen gave a statement that was directly contradictory in which she said she never paid money for stolen probes. So it directly contradicts her. It's a Confrontation Clause violation. And, Your Honor, he said to Judge Lasnik, I didn't object because you told me I had a continuing objection. Am I getting that right? And the judge responded at ER 152, yes, I agree with you, and I'm granting you a continuing objection in that regard. So then fast forward to when the statements come in through Merck's counsel's cross-examination, no objection because we have a continuing objection already in that regard. And the only other rule I think we have to look at is the federal rule of evidence, which I didn't write down here, but it's in my brief. I think it's 103, which says that after a decision by the district court, quote, admitting or excluding evidence, close quote, there's no need to re-raise the objection at the trial at the time that the evidence is either admitted or excluded.
You know, the government raises a whole raft of anti-Crawford arguments, including saying that the statement was exculpatory. Was it exculpatory falsehood? It wasn't offered for truth. What's your response to the arguments on the Crawford merits?
I'd like to talk about whether it was a falsely exculpatory statement that was admitted for something other than the truth, Your Honor, because if it was, it's something that nobody ever clued the jury into. And in fact, if you look at the government's theory of the case, it was neither false nor exculpatory. In the statement, Merck did not deny stealing probes for money. He admitted receiving money for medical devices. That's a quote from his statement. Medical devices. He never limited the medical devices that he received money for to scrap circuit boards, as the government seems to suggest. He never denied receiving the $500,000 that the agent brought up. Instead, he said, I admit taking medical devices from ATL Phillips. I admit selling them to both of the Nguyens and getting paid for them. So as a factual matter, it was neither false according to the government's theory nor exculpatory. But I want to talk about it as a legal matter also.
How did the government argue that?
I'm sorry?
The statement that came in, how did the government, if it wasn't for the, how did the government use those statements in their argument? What did they say that meant when they were arguing their case?
They argued that Tuit Nguyen received stolen probes for money And
did they specifically ever in their argument in the record say, and this is how we know it because look at what Mr. Merck said?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. And if I can't find it on rebuttal, if the court would permit me to submit something, say, tomorrow.
That's all right.
But the key is that this was different from anything else that would allow them to say this, because Merck's was the only direct testimony on it. The rest was kind of a paper chase, a paper trail.
Well, it was, but direct and circumstantial evidence, I mean, we all know that instruction that we don't understand that says circumstantial is just as good as direct. I mean, I read it for 20 years, and then finally one day the light went on. But so, I mean, the fact that this is the only direct and there's other circumstantial, I mean, it really comes down to whether if we accept your argument that it was error, and if we accept that it was preserved, and then it's beyond a reasonable doubt would be the standard, it really goes to how much other evidence there was, right, in terms of what the effect of the error was.
Oh, you're certainly entitled to
that. So just the fact that one's direct, and circumstantial evidence can be some of the strongest cases sometimes.
Correct, but I don't agree that it depends on just how much other evidence there was. Certainly, quality matters.
Yeah, I mean, if it's beyond, if it's an overwhelming case, let's say.
Agreed.
Well, why don't you address
the legal,
for my benefit, your argument as to why all of the other circumstantial evidence taken as a whole isn't enough to make a Crawford violation harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
I would like to do that. If you permit me, I'd like to give the final portion of my answer to your last question, which is whether it's falsely exculpatory and therefore not hearsay. And I'd like to say that there's a legal answer to that as well, because Crawford says that it's sometimes possible to admit this stuff if it's not being admitted for the truth of the matter. It cites, though, to Tennessee versus Street. Tennessee versus Street is a really limited U.S. Supreme Court case which held that a confession that was admitted in that case was not admitted in violation of the Confrontation Clause, even though it was the co-defendant's confession, because it was not admitted for the truth of the matter. But the specifics of that case were that it was a case where the defendant was arguing that he was coerced into making a copycat confession, something that tracked the other guy's confession. So the government was then permitted to introduce the other guy's confession to show that it didn't track it. The question in that case was, what did the confession say? The question in our case is not, what did Merck's confession say? The question in our case is, what actually happened at the time of the thefts? So I think there's a legal argument against construing this as something that was not admitted for the truth value either. Your question, your following question is comparing the evidence that was admitted other than Merck's statements that he was selling directly. There was a lot of other evidence admitted. There were the material.
The checks, right? The checks to cash?
Correct. In fact, if you look at the government's brief, I think on page 11, I was going to get to this in the Santos argument, they summarized the three categories of checks that were written, checks written that say Merck and Probes, checks written that just say Probes, checks written that went into the personal account and then money went out of the personal account, material transfer forms, testimony of Davies, which implicated Phu Nguyen rather than Thuyet Nguyen. So there was a lot of paperwork, a lot of checks, a lot of notations showing money going around in a circle. I agree with Judge Callahan that there was quantity. I disagree that it was of the same quality as direct evidence out of Merck's mouth explaining what was going on. And Merck is more important than Davies or anybody else because he was the one who was pointed to by the government as having been involved in this for the longest period of time and having supplied them with, I believe, $500,000 worth of probes.
And Merck didn't testify, right?
Merck did not testify.
So there wasn't any opportunity
during the trial. There was nobody to cross-examine. It all came in through Special Agent Borden.
Sometime before you're done, you should at least touch on the misbranding. At least, you know, to get you into the issue of concern to me, it seems to me that probably there is precedent saying that materiality is an element. But yet, here it seems so obviously material that serial numbers are changed, obvious in terms of other testimony, that I'm having trouble seeing how not giving that element as part of the charge would affect substantial rights of Ms. Nguyen.
Well, I think it's undisputed at this point that materiality is an element. I think the government admits this at page 41 of their brief. I think they also admit that the to convict, the elements instruction, lacks this element. And I think it's pretty clear that jury instruction number 30, which says that it's one among many items that you can consider, makes it a consideration, not a required
element. Right, right. But how do you address, if you would please, how not instructing on materiality affects the substantial rights of Ms. Nguyen in light of the other evidence?
Well, the question is, what's the materiality, whether it's important that there was a different number on the outside than there was on the inside when the inside number was accessible as well. The government's theory was that the outside number mattered primarily in the event that there was a recall, and of course there was no evidence of any recall. The defense, however, presented evidence that it was really not material at all to anybody, that it was not a unique number in the early numbering system. They were duplicated. It was primarily an inventory control number, so it might be important to ATL Phillips in terms of tracking stuff, but it wasn't material to any of the customers exactly what the number was in terms of quality or whether it was going to help or hurt patients. And that for a number of these probes, they were basically mix and match probes. So the outside number really was of limited value anyway because it wasn't what it began with. When these things are sent in to be fixed, they fix them by taking a little bit from this probe and taking a little bit of that from that probe and putting it in. So the outside numbers certainly... If
any obliterated serial numbers, I think it would be, you'd be hard-pressed if you surveyed 100 people. I think if you asked people, what do you think, they'd say, it's stolen.
Well, the question isn't whether it's stolen. The question whether obliteration is material. And to the purchaser, what was material was quality. To ATL Phillips, what they cared about was profits and inventory control.
Don't you think you might care if it was stolen?
They might care, but they might not. They might care primarily about material, about quality, and they were getting high quality. So in terms of, I think there's arguments on both sides. I think that the key is that it's a jury question, whether the government's argument that it's material primarily in the event of a recall, which never occurred, would have carried the day, or defense argument that nobody cared since they knew that the stuff coming from the Nguyens was consistently high quality, and the number on the outside didn't really tell anybody what was on the inside since they were mix and match parts.
You've got about 2 minutes left. Do you want to save some time for rebuttal?
I want to spend about 1 minute on Santos.
Well, I need a little time, too. I need to ask one quick question, and
How much time is the panel wants?
Well, I just wanted to ask you a quick question so that I understand. You questioned about for resentencing on the loss because you said the district court didn't rule on factual objections.
Correct.
All right. If I agreed with that, is it possible that she could go back and get more, get a higher number?
My argument would be no, based on North Carolina versus Pierce, which holds that you can't punish the defendant, of course, for appealing.
But what the court said here was, I'm just going to give you a little break and kind of cut you a little slack and go down. But now the appellate court says, sorry, you can't cut people slack without going through all the numbers, and you got to come up with it in a reasoned way. That's not punishing someone on an appeal. That's like, they're following the appellate court.
That's not an issue that was raised on appeal. There was no cross appeal on whether her sentence was too low, Your Honor.
So she could get more time, maybe. I mean, more loss.
I think the answer is that this court cannot write opinion saying that she should get more time because the numbers were too low, because that was not an issue that was raised by me on appeal, and there was no cross appeal by the government.
If part of the findings of the court was set aside on rulings on the evidentiary problem, the court could, even if we sent it back for resentencing, the court could reimpose the original sentence, couldn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you're not ahead much except counts, right?
Well, I think I might be ahead if we did a resentencing.
Oh, okay.
I think there's, you know, I'm often in this position, and sometimes there's things that you think of it resentencing, and sometimes perhaps the comparison with what her husband did, and sometimes perhaps how she's been behaving since the conviction are relevant.
I don't have to deal with it, but I sure worry that attorneys don't worry about it sometimes.
I'm sorry, say it again?
I don't worry about it in connection with my work, but I do worry about attorneys that don't think about it before they come up here.
I appreciate that, Your Honor, and I understand that the district court could certainly impose the same sentence as a legal matter.
It was a calculated risk here.
Thank you, Your Honor. I see that my time has expired.
Okay. Well, it looks like I'm making a habit of it today. We'll give you an extra 1 minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, Ms. Lotz. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Susan Lloyds. I was one of trial counsel in this matter. Going straight to the Crawford-Bruton-related issue, I think it is significant that this was raised by, these questions were raised by Mr. Merck's counsel. And I,
Ms. Lloyds, why is that significant? You know, putting aside whether it might be harmless under Chapman, but just as to whether it's a Crawford violation, if we have testimony by a government agent that Mr. Merck said she bought stolen goods from him, you know, why isn't that like a classic Crawford violation?
Well, I think the issue, Your Honor, is that by, and I would disagree with what counsel said, that Mr. Merck's counsel did not make it known that he was going to take this position. A week before this trial started, he told everybody in the courtroom that his client was going to admit that he had stolen probes, or that he had stolen goods. He equated it to $150,000 in his account. That's not scrap material. That would have to be probes. She did not move to sever. That's really the difference, is that here she either had to make it very clear under Crawford or Bruton, or more appropriately, say that there were inconsistent defenses and ask for severance of the trial. And she never did that.
She didn't ask for severance. But why would that be a defense if there is a Crawford violation?
Well, I would say that she did waive it, but let's say that you determine that she didn't waive it. The standard then is, did it result in a problem in the trial? And here, I would also make it clear, he did not, this testimony at trial had nothing to do with probes. There were two statements that he gave.
Well, that's where I just, where I don't follow you at all, and I suppose it's just not having traction with me at all. I don't see where, it doesn't appear to me that they waived the objection, but I'm listening to everything. This theory that you're saying it's not coming in for the truth of the matter, I was a prosecutor for a long time, and I absolutely am just, it's not getting traction with me.
Well, I think the difference I want to make is that it's not about probes, which is what the trial was about. He did admit to taking some material and selling it to the Nguyen's.
It said there were stolen items or stolen equipment.
What he said was scrap, scrap material. And I think that's substantively different than stolen probes, which was what all of the counts were about.
Was
stolen probes
aren't
material?
Well, he didn't admit to. If you read the testimony of the agent, and it was covered by Mr. Mestel in cross-examination, did he admit to probes? And it's very clear that he did not admit to stealing probes, and that's what the trial was about.
Didn't the agent use some general word like equipment or items that would cover probes?
That's true.
So then what's the big deal?
Well, there,
if the agent said, Merck said he sold stolen items to Ms. Nguyen, then what does it matter if he didn't admit they were probes?
I guess the difference that I would say that I think does make a difference, it was scrap, which I think is a minimalization of what he did. Because probes, as we talked about in the loss amount, conservatively worth $8,000 apiece.
How did the government argue this particular evidence?
We definitely argued, the reason we wanted this statement to come in, into the limited amount that we did, was because it was false. And we were arguing that he lied about saying he only took scrap, he wasn't admitting probes, so why do you lie? Why do you lie? You lie because you want to cover up what you've really done. The same thing with respect.
Why isn't this just directly on point as to her knowledge? I mean, why doesn't this evidence just, and did you argue that in the trial?
I'm sorry?
Did you argue in the trial that that showed that she had knowledge?
I don't think we argued that as to her knowledge. Our focus was on the checks that she wrote, the difference in the inventory forms that showed, or their inventory records that showed that they did not have, they could not track a bunch of their inventory. For example, Mr. Merck is not listed on the vendor list, so her knowledge there, her particularly the signing of the checks, was significant. The denial that she had done any business with him, which was her statement that came in during the trial, all of that was her knowledge.
Why don't you address those issues in terms of the Chapman harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard?
Right.
If we decide it was a Crawford violation.
I think that is certainly the way the court can decide this case. There was powerful and convincing evidence.
Then you need to give me your best evidence on that.
I'd say my number one evidence are the checks to cash that mention purchasing probes, most of them say probes, from Merck. Some of them say equipment. She signed, of those 112 checks, she signed, I think, 46 of them, something like that. That means you have to go to the bank to get the cash. She negotiated many of those checks. I think that is evidence that she knew, contrary to her lie to the police department, that she, in fact, was buying probes from Mr. Merck. And then the accounting records also show that. The vast difference between their purchases by item detail reports and their sales by item details. They show a lot more record of sales than they show for purchases. They're not keeping track of their purchases that are stolen property. So I think under the harmless error standard, the powerful evidence shows that despite any argument that she could make with respect to Mr. Merck's questioning, the conviction should stand.
Okay, if we determine that there's a Crawford violation, and if, contrary to your argument, we conclude there might have been some doubt, but it's not beyond a reasonable doubt. If there is such a violation that's not harmless, which convictions fall?
Well, I would assume the conspiracy conviction and the stolen property convictions.
What about the money laundering conviction?
Well, money laundering was based on the stolen property
conviction. So that was false too, right?
Correct.
And those could be retried, but they would all be out. The only thing left would be the misbranding.
I think that's right, Your Honor.
Okay, so let's focus on the misbranding for a moment for my benefit.
All right.
As I understand it, materiality is an element.
Correct.
But what's the government's argument that failure to object on that, putting you under a plain error standard, would support the conclusion that her substantial rights were not affected?
Well, I'd say let's start with the Supreme Court case. Particularly with respect to materiality, the Supreme Court said in the Nader case that it's harmless if the reviewing court can conclude that the evidence proves the omitted element beyond a reasonable doubt. And here I think we did that very clearly. The changing of the serial numbers was a significant part of their effort to steal stolen property. They were able to cover up that they were stealing stolen property by changing the serial numbers. It clearly was material, and it clearly was stated such by multiple of the witnesses. We had three different customers who bought goods from Columbia Medical Systems who said that it was very material to them that the serial number be the original equipment manufacturing label, which means it's the original serial number and it was put there by the manufacturer, in this case Phillips. In connection with that, the witness from General Electric, who is one of their biggest customers, Mr. Parker, testified that they stopped doing business with Columbia Medical Systems when they heard that there was a problem that they might be stealing probes. When they went back to continue to do business with them after a year or so period of time, they entered into a written contract, and the written contract has in bold face, this has to be original equipment serial numbers. So it clearly was material to the purchasers. Whether or not there was a recall or not, I don't think matters, because it was material in the event that a recall might have happened in the future. That's what they want, is the original equipment serial number. And two of their customers, I think, testified to that directly.
How does the material, that the misbranding the second set of serial numbers, how does that relate to the body of evidence in evaluating harmless error if you find a Crawford violation?
Well, I think the fact that there are false serial numbers on the probes is proof that they are stolen. There really is no other reason to change, in my view, to change the serial number unless they are stolen. So I think it is further proof that they were dealing in stolen property. It was a way to facilitate the stolen property crime.
No other manufacturer?
I'm sorry?
There is no other manufacturer of a probe?
No, there are different types of probes. General Electric actually, I think, produced their own. But with respect to these particular labels, the customers recognized them as Phillips labels. And it was a Phillips brand and a Phillips device that were at issue here.
So what did it actually look like when you would have these two serial numbers?
The only serial number that a customer would see is the outside label, which is what looked like the Phillips label, but had, in the case of the stolen probes, a false serial number. They used the same color. They used the same configuration of, kind of how it looked, but they were false. They were false. You could tell in two different ways. It was a comparison of the serial number when we actually physically had the probe, because you needed to do this, but to run a computer test that would show you the computer-embedded serial number. And you could do that if you physically had the probe. So we were limited in how many of those we could prove that way. And if they were different, then the exterior label was false. With respect to the probes at issue here, which were newer label probes. With respect to another way you could tell that they were false, is at least some of them, is the configuration of certain numbers and letters that were not allowed in the Phillips serial number system, that when the Nguyen's created a false label, they used some of those characters that were verboten under the real serial number system. And so we had a summary at the end of the trial of probes that were false numbers, and they were done in two different ways. They were done by that comparison of the internal versus the external, and also by violating the Phillips labeling system.
Well, there was also evidence in the trial that obviously the Wins had previously worked for Phillips, too.
Correct.
Right?
And knew Mr. Merck. With respect to the money laundering jury instruction, I wanted to point out one additional thing, and that is the general knowledge instruction in the Stein case is significantly different than what we had at issue here. In both the Stein case and in this case, that instruction started off by saying, an act is done knowingly if the defendant is aware of the act and does not act through ignorance, mistake, or accident. That's in both Stein and here. In Stein, however, there was an additional sentence that said, the government is not required to prove that the defendant knew that his acts or omissions were unlawful. That's what the problem was in the Stein case. We did not have that sentence in this case. And in fact, the very next jury instruction following general knowledge jury instruction specifically addressed that in order to find that she acted knowingly, you had to find beyond a reasonable doubt that she was aware of a high probability that the probes were stolen and deliberately avoided learning the truth, and that you couldn't find that she had the knowledge if she acted, if she believed that the probes were not stolen. So it's really completely the opposite situation that was present in Stein. With respect to the sentencing disparity issue, I wanted to point out that the section of 3553 that's applicable here is A6, and it says that you are to avoid the, you are, one of the goals is the need to avoid unwarranted sentence disparities among defendants with similar records who have been found guilty of similar conduct. And here, Mr. Nguyen pled guilty only to the money laundering conspiracy. She was found guilty of 3 additional types of crimes and 6 more counts than her husband. And that, I believe, is what the court was addressing when he went through the various different factors in sentencing. Is there any other particular issue that the court would like me to address?
I don't have anything, Jeff. Can I answer, please? Thanks, Ms. Lutz.
Thank you.
We appreciate your argument for us. Thank you. Ms. McLeod, we give you an extra minute here.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll talk quickly. Counsel for the government said that Mr. Merck's counsel alerted the court in advance of the trial that he would admit Mr. Merck's testimony, so we should have objected prior to that. Well, when counsel alerts the court that they're going to admit Mr. Merck's testimony, you expect the guy to testify. That was what the alert was. Merck didn't testify. Instead, it was elicited through Agent Borden. So I don't think that that was a clue that there was going to be a Crawford problem coming through Seth Merck rather than the government. With regard to the misbranding, I think I agree with the court's analysis as to the reach of the Crawford error, and that the misbranding convictions are going to have to stand or fall on the omission of the materiality issue. With regard to the materiality issue, I would only add the jury actually acquitted Tuit Nguyen of 10 counts, including, I think, 3 of the misbranding counts. So it's not like they, it's not like there was overwhelming evidence, at least as far as the jury saw it. And I've gone over my overtime.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I appreciate the excellent argument on both sides.
I agree. Thank you both for your argument.
U.S. v. Nguyen shall be submitted.